the UCR Podcast.
We've got a fun one for fans of Steve Howe, and yes, today we have a conversation with Steve to talk about a lot of things, but in particular, his experience recording an album's worth of Bob Dylan covers. 1999's Portraits of Bob Dylan is one of two records that Steve is reissuing September 12th on his own label, Howe Sounds. Both the Portraits album as well as 2001's Natural Timber will be available on CD and, for the first time, vinyl as well. I've always been fascinated by Steve's journey with his solo work, so it was a pleasure to be able to dig into that with him and also hear stories about his time working with Delaney and Bonnie, recording with Queen, and a few stray Yes anecdotes as well. Steve and Yes will be on the road this fall performing the Fragile album in full, and as he shares with us, there's a lot on the horizon to look forward to. You can stay up to date with Steve and Yes at stevehowe.com and yesworld.com. If this is your first time coming across the UCR podcast, make sure to follow us wherever you're listening so that you will receive future episodes as they're released. And if you're a fellow Yes fan, we've got plenty of things for you to read, including our ranking of the more than 200 songs in the Yes catalog, an epic project that my comrade Ryan Reed took on. You can find that and many, many other things at ultimateclassicrock.com. Right now, please enjoy our conversation with Steve Howe.
Hi, Matt.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thanks. How are you?
I'm good, man. Thank you for taking some time this morning.
Okay.
It's afternoon for you.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's 2:15.
You've got reissues of a couple of your albums that are coming out. And of course, because it's you, like, these are albums that found you at the time going down a different pathway with each one. There's, of course, Natural Timber, which, you know, came out in 2001. And then prior to that, 1999's Portraits of Bob Dylan. And I wanted to focus on the Dylan album. How did Bob's music first land on your radar, Steve?
Oh, yeah. So sometime those early 60s, you know, I was drumming away and I heard the album Freewheeling. In fact, I bought the album Freewheeling when that came out. So I kind of missed his first album, but the second album caught me, you know, Blowing in the Wind and so many great songs. So I started to be pretty interested in this guy. Who is he, you know? And then, of course, you know, The Other Side of Dylan, Another Side of Dylan came out. And it was so compelling, this guy with a guitar, you know, with songs like Hattie Carroll and all these, you know, very, very broad ideas. So lyrically, rhythmically, you know, vocally, he was a sound, you know, a new sound. And that harmonica and the fact that your parents hated him and because the kind of whiny. So he was a great ambassador for the young people, you know, who were just getting into the Beatles and all that stuff. But Bob was just a separate entity.
How were you processing music at that point? Like, it sounds like you were already looking at what Bob was doing through more of a fellow musician's lens, but did it hit you as a fan first, or how did that happen?
I think both simultaneously, really. I mean, if you hear great music, then you engage in it on both those levels, you know. He was very, very he drew people to him, even though he maybe didn't know he did. So there was a lot to it, really. Yeah, like I was seeing it on a few levels. I don't think I can genuinely say that you know that this guy is going to, you know, spend his whole life writing brilliant songs like he has done. But definitely there was great potential.
And I like that among the cast of characters playing with you on this record, you, of course, are working again with, you know, Dylan, your son, and, you know, his name, as I understand it, comes from both Bob and Dylan Thomas, which is a fine cocktail of inspiration for a name. Was Dylan's music anything that you all shared at all as he was growing up, as far as a shared love?
Oh, yeah. Dylan, you know, being our eldest, he was not only into Bowie, you know, when he was a teenager, he was only known to Bowie and all this, but he'd also, I don't think unwillingly, you know, been aware of the music that we loved and been part of that. Yeah, he became part of it. He likes it. Presley, you know, Dylan. Yeah, he's very, very broad. I suppose he's as broad as I am in his musical taste. He's leaned a lot towards jazz, but in fact, his general view of music is that he likes to listen and play more or less any kind of music.
That's fantastic. And what's kind of striking about the 90s is that it was a very prolific decade for you as far as the amount of solo stuff you had coming out. Like, you'd made a couple of solo things in the mid to late 70s, and then yes. It's not hard to imagine that things just got too busy for you as you get into the 80s, everything that happened that decade, Asia, GTR, yes, and so on. So if we look at the beginning of the 90s, like what kind of brings you back to working solo in the beginning of the 90s with Turbulence? Because obviously you'd been doing some other stuff, Steve, along the way outside of band work. I mean, things like the Transportation album with Billy Currie prior to that came to mind.
Yes. Well, it's fascinating. You know, basically, although the 80s were jammed up, you know, with Asia, GTR and ABWH and Yes Union, I was actually recording Turbulence during that period. And Billy Currie, you know, that's why he plays on Turbulence, because he was part of that. So I had it ready and it came out in the 90s. And that set a new kind of goal for me, really. I suddenly thought, well, you know, for 3-4 years, I wasn't in a band, you know, and that's not often that there's a period like that. So 91 to 94, I was really out doing solo. And I'd realized that touring with Asia, the rebadged, if you like, Asia, I could do that on my own. So after doing it with Asia, I went around the clubs of America and I started doing a lot more solo work, which I love very, very much. And but then got caught up again, you know, like you could have predicted. Yes came along the middle and we did Keys and then we did, you know, all sorts of other things. So that was a lovely time when I was more independent. And but I run that parallel. I'm never not a solo guitarist as well.
It's kind of interesting because it's like, I think that you obviously were able to play some smaller venues with the solo tours. And I know that like one place that you played here in Cleveland, you know, at least a few times was the Cleveland Agora, you know, so it had to be kind of good to kind of get back into rooms like that. I think that probably informs your perspective in a different way when you kind of go back to your roots in that way.
Yeah. The theater circuit, you know, is something I can really deal with. You know, it feels right to be in that environment. And, you know, I guess that's where I did most of my bulge treading, you know, right from early days I can think of the Delaney and Bonnie tour in 1969, where I played all the venues that I would then play repeatedly with Yes, you know. So it's marvelous when you get those kind of introductions and you're able to get your feet wet and start to build your confidence and your goals, really, and keep being, I was continually trying to be the guitarist I was meant to be, you know, to my own conscience, if you like. So that meant that although a lot of time in the first half of my learning the guitar was about, it's kind of like building my technique so I could play, you know, a bit like Albert, a bit like Chet, a bit like Wes, you know, a bit kind of mix all the bag up, you know. But then I think by the time I got to 2000, I sort of like, that's why Bob Dylan album seems so timely for me. I mean, the acoustic album was great fun to do, put the electrics away for an album. But the Bob songs that I chose were meaningful to me and about love forlorn a little bit, you know, and but also gave me the opportunity to kind of be a different musician in a way, because I wasn't writing the music. I had to arrange all the stuff and work out who's going to sing it and change the key for something if somebody wanted, or, you know. So basically my job function was actually quite different. You know, it felt different and I was pleased that it felt differently, because I do like changes that are more subtle than you know, suddenly only being an acoustic guitarist or suddenly only being this or that. I refuse to be pigeonholed, and also I refuse to be one person. You know, I'm a multi-guitarist, and it implies really what my career has been about.
Before I move onward, you made a mention of the Delaney and Bonnie tour, and you know what, Steve, like that's one where it's like, I think you hear people talk a good amount about two different tours. One of them is the Mad Dogs and Englishmen tour, and the other one is the Delaney and Bonnie tour. That seems like that would have been, it's described as kind of being, both those tours are kind of described as being crazy, chaotic experiences. Like, how did it feel being out on that particular tour? What kind of sticks with you about that run?
Well, I mean, it was just great. All I can say is it gave me a look at really how people carry on when they're successful, you know, because we were with Eric and George and you know, Dave Mason and so many guys who'd already made their mark, and I was sort of the unknown guitarist. So I was in a great spot. I could watch everybody. I could feed off of it. And once they invited me, Eric actually invited me to jam with them. And, you know, that's the only thing in my entire career I regret saying no to. The reason I said no was there were a multitude of guitarists on stage, and I almost couldn't see the wood for the trees there, how I would do it. Of course, it would have been great, and it would have been a lovely thing to say I had done. Instead, I say I didn't do it. But there you are. It was very enjoyable. It was wild. It was wacky. There was a lot of craziness in a way, but it was contained, pleasant craziness. You know, it wasn't, you know, head banging, annoying craziness. It was just a bit of wildness. You know, some of the guys are letting off a lot of steam, getting a bit wrecked, you know, but the music didn't suffer. You know? I mean, when these guys, I'll tell you the short story, when P.P. Arnold had invited me to be in her band with Ashton Gardner and Dyke, we went to the Lyceum in London one afternoon to just before the tour started and to meet the guys and maybe practice there or something. So we walk in and they're playing and we're like, oh my God, this is, you know, I mean, the Southern rock music had not really been properly explored in the UK. And suddenly, yeah, here we were, 1969. Instead of it being like, you know, it could have been the Byrds or other bands, you know, but this band was kind of obscure. Eric had cleverly picked a band that had cred, but hadn't really like moved up to that gear. And he helped them do that. And they were such a lot of fun. They were so nice and pleasant. It was always about musicianship and respect. And Eric was one of the kindest people I know. You know, he bought dinner for everybody every night. You know, it was a wonderful experience. So don't let me tell you anymore. It was just great.
You know, what you said about turning down that jam with Eric, like, it's not hard to imagine that, like, for you as a guitar player, when you find yourself playing with, you know, people like Eric and George and, you know, Dave, like, people that in a lot of cases you've been hearing the records prior to obviously becoming a professional musician, like, that seems to me like that would be intimidating in any universe.
Well, yeah, but I've been very, very careful not to lose my perspective, you know, I guess is one way of describing it. So wherever I am, whether I'm like, imagine me, I'm, you know, I've worked at my guitar. I've been playing over 64 years or something crazy like that. But, you know, when I play with Martin Taylor, he can do things just seem impossible, you know. So similarly, when I was with that band around those people, you know, it was a real learning curve. I was really picking up on a lot. And I can't say I did it consciously, but I think subconsciously I was really thinking, yeah, okay, so you get a Fender Dual Showman. Yeah, let's have one of those. You know, it was like, okay, so you've got to look fairly smart. Yeah, and you've got to be able to talk a little and be nice with the audience. So I was kind of learning the ropes beyond twiddling around on the guitar and just being like, I was fairly nerdy at first when I used to play. I used to stand rigidly still and my guitar was almost like Bill Wyman's, you know, bass. It was quite,
wow, yeah,
like quite up there. And I wasn't a rock and roller, but I gradually, you know, I got that feel and I learned, you know, how to be a little bit more than a guitarist. I think when you go on stage, you have to be a little bit of an entertainer in some way, or you have to let your music flow, you know, direct you. And that's a good thought I've just had, is that was when I realized, I think, that you let your music lead your career. There's nothing else can lead it. It's your music. And when I heard, you know, I'm coming home to your love, to do it all done, you know, I was like, okay, this is serious music. I mean, this is wonderful, rich music. And I allowed that to it. That's why Yes did, you know, Paul Simon's America. And it includes a piece that Paul Simon agreed to allow me to credit called Southern Solo, which is a whole load of Delaney and Bonnie stuff. You know, I love those guys. Well, I didn't rip them off, you know, exactly. In fact, I added a lot of my own guitar licks that I had floating around that weren't going anywhere. So I put them all into that solo, and I call it Southern Solo, out of respect for Delaney and Bonnie with Eric. You know, it was a wonderful time. Are we still talking about that? It's great.
Oh, man. Well, I'm glad that you mentioned Paul Simon's America, because as you were talking about all that, like, and you were talking about how you were not, like, say, a rockin' player initially, that was really kind of the first thing I thought of, was like, you know, when I saw you play live with Yes in do something like America, like that is something that like shows off Steve Howe as the rocking guitarist. And it's like really the approach that Yes took to that song really just put that song in a whole new light that is equally as powerful, but in a different way compared to the way that Paul approached it with his version.
Absolutely. Yeah. I asked Paul, you know, when I met him in 1993 in Miami, I said to him, do you like Yes? He said, yeah, I really like Yes's version. So I was pleased with that. That's where I approached the Southern Solo idea. But yeah, I mean, you don't often hear back from anybody if you cover their song. It would be nice if people bothered to do that, but they don't. And generally, you'd never know, really. I don't know how Bob Dylan felt about, even though I was in touch with his manager who gave me the song Well, 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 to an unreleased song. So back, he was very receptive and very friendly, but, you know, and I wouldn't expect there's no commitment that somebody has to comment, but that's it. You don't have to comment.
Well, you mentioned Martin Taylor, and it's like, I love what you kind of said about like playing with somebody like that and going, okay, this guy can do some things that maybe I can't do or haven't thought about doing in that way. And I think that's kind of what I was thinking as I was like looking at what you have done with some of your solo records, like Portraits of Bob Dylan, like Turbulence, where it's like you're bringing in different players and people. It just seems like, one, it's obviously fun to get out of your usual box, but it's like you can put together these fantasy groupings of players, and it's like there's no doubt that you're going to come away from experiences of playing with all these guys picking up some things that perhaps were not in your toolbox prior to that.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I don't think you ever play with another musician without gaining something. You know, it's an opportunity you have. You know, you've got your instrument, they've got their instrument. Let's see what we can do. It's quite tantalizing, really. But also, you've got to let the mood and the opportunity. You've got to realize what it is. You know, you're going to do. Depends, obviously, what in fact it is. But when I invited people to sing on the album, you know, it was very harmonious, and you know, I liked that contact, and they said, yeah, okay, yeah. And we worked things out, how that was going to be possible to do that. And I was delighted, you know, with everybody's contribution. And it ranges, as you see, you know, quite a broad vocal spectrum from GTR's vocalist, you know, Max Baker.
Max,
really made a mark, you know, when he came out. I thought he was a stayer, you know, a real stayer. And I think he should have been. But then, you know, like going back to find people who I'd like to work with. But of course, John Anderson was a logical and wonderful idea there. And he said, oh, I like your list, but I like those songs, but I'd rather do Sad Eyes Over the Lowlands. So in fact, I had a new quest there. You know, it was really exciting. I was like, oh, okay, all right, that's a challenge for me. So I worked out how to do that. And as you said, Dylan Howe has been such an integral part of my solo career he's been my main collaborator. So knowing he was going to come out and do the drums, and he came out to Montreux, where they had a kit identical to his, a Gretsch kit, already set up in the room that Freddie Mercury liked so much. So Dave Richards was the engineer who did all the Queen work, and also when I played on Innuendo, not wishing to name drop, but
so it's a good name drop though.
Yeah, it's a good name drop. So Dylan coming out doing the drums and then is establishing how the hell we're going to put this in together. And Dave Richards was a great asset for me. And it's sad that we lost him years back. But, you know, he was a real worker.
How did you get wrapped into playing on Innuendo?
Well, very briefly, I was in a cafe in Montreux, I'd just come in from Geneva, and I was staying in Geneva, and I was going there because I love Montreux. So somebody walked by, a crew guy walked by and spotted me, came in and said, hey, the guys are in the studio. You better come down and see them. So by the time I went there, about an hour later, it was a setup. It was strangely enough, they'd already set this up. So I walk in and they say, hello, and how are you doing? Great, great, great. I said, look, we want to play you the album. So I said, I got time, play it. So they played all the album except Innuendo. And at the end, they played Innuendo. So when it finished, I went, amazing, amazing album, just amazing. So they said, yeah, but we want you to play on that. So I said, well, I can't imagine it. So show me. So they went to the spot that I play in. And I said, well, look, Brian's got great guitars there. You know, do you sure? So they said, yeah, just impro. Just go a bit wild. And you remember Paco de Lucia? I said, well, I can't play like that guy. But I know what you mean. You want some impro that isn't like formulated. So we did a few takes. You know, we mucked around. We had a few laughs. I tried, he had a couple of the guitars we used. The same guitar I use, called a Gibson Chet Atkins, is like an electric Spanish guitar. It's a beautiful thing that Chet designed. So Brian was playing those. So I borrowed one of his, did some impros, went to dinner with Freddie. And when we came back with the band, and then when we came back, I mean, Montreux is a lovely place to have dinner, you know. So when we come back, I'm like, okay, so we tweaked, you know, what I'd done. We used a bit of take one and maybe take four's best at the end, or take three. I don't know how many takes I did. So we had a guitar, you know, and we agreed on it. And I said, I'm okay with that. Great. Okay. So I seem to remember that Brian then gave me a lift to the station. I think I'd come in by train that day from Geneva.
Well, you know, you mentioned Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, and that is such a brilliant Dylan song. And it's a long song, and Bob is not somebody who goes long a lot, but when he does, it's often really interesting. So I love the way that John was kind of the one that said, how about this song? Like, ultimately, what did you end up digging about the song, you know, once you kind of dug into it?
Well, I mean, I love the song to bits. I mean, that was one of the key sure. songs. You know, for Blonde on Blonde. So there was no doubt it was a great choice. And I liked it that I hadn't chosen it, partly because it was so long. I wondered if anybody wanted to take that on. So I beavered away on that. It became a very special project for me to get that song arranged, because I had to kind of get a texturization going on where the song would kind of have different verses, you know, have different instruments, you know, and they come into play and they play a different sort of thing. So it gradually kind of builds up. But that and Lonesome Death of the Head of Carol has a lot of verses as well, which Dean Dyson, a friend of mine, not so well known singer, sung beautifully for us in his big, big masculine, you know, Brit voice. So basically,
I love his voice. Yeah,
yeah, isn't it great? You know, Williams and singer kill poor Hardy. I mean, he sings it like wow, he's meant to sing that song. So
he sounds like an old school country singer.
He does a bit. Yes, I know. He put on a twist. And for some Brit singers, they can't help singing a song that comes from America a little bit Americanized. I don't mind sure. it. You have to accept it. It kind of comes with the flavor of the whole song. So, yeah, Sad Eyed was very special, getting those textures, getting the build and getting Dylan's drum. It's such a wonderful song. It's a bit like, you know, Canon by Pastel. It's a piece that repeats. And yet the intriguing thing about the lyrics is you kind of partly know what he's singing about and you partly don't know. So it's a kind of a magical mix.
Yeah. And for Sad Eyed, your guitar tone, when we first hear it, particularly like in the early part of the song, has that sound like maybe it's running through a Leslie cabinet. Like, would it have been that simple? Like, how do you kind of get that sound?
Yeah, I would think that was a Leslie. It was a clean guitar put through a Leslie cabinet, or it's a simulation that I like sufficiently, because Korg did something around that time called an A3, and it had some remarkable, very early generation digital guitar processing that was just amazing, and I've still got it. So it may have been the chorusing, and that could have been a regular guitar. Yeah, I was determined to do the organ part, if you like, on that, a bit like I did, I think, on Just Like a Woman as well, where I diddle, yeah. diddle, diddle. So it's a temptation to mimic the sound, and but you need some, you need a story, you know, you need things like that. So when I built all those times that guitar would come in, that's what I do. That's my multi-guitaring. I have this ready here, and then I have another guitar ready here. It's like an armory of guitars.
The Portraits album comes out in July of 99, just a, you know, relatively short period before The Ladder. Like, and I know that a lot of folks, you know, things are always very separate, you know, between like, you know, whatever they're doing solo and whatever they're doing with their main project, whatever that is. Like, how much does the Steve Howe working on this album cross yeah. paths with Steve Howe of The Ladder era? Like, do the two projects feed each other at all as far as your musical frame of mind at that time?
That's really a fascinating question. I'm just trying to think. I would say that working with, you know, Bruce Fairbairn, which was an absolute yeah. if not a tragedy as well, but it was absolute thrill. He was great. He beat us up so much. He was great at telling us that we didn't know how to make records anymore. Now, I just made that film. You know, I'd just been the producer, but it's a lot easier when you're only controlling, well, my guests, you know, and Dylan. It was a piece of cake compared to making a Yes record, any Yes record. But there again, when Bruce came on, it was a whole new experience. And, you know, he took us down a different sort of road. And I gave myself up to him totally. I was anything he wanted. I would have said, all right, I'll work on that. And we all did that. And that was a beautiful thing. So when we lost him, we also lost that guy, you know, like they say about Brian Epstein with the Beatles, or so many other people have somebody. And if you lose them, it changes things a lot. So we had to finish the record without him, except for Nine Voices, which shows you what he was after in the delicacy and the precision of Nine Voices was something he nurtured quite a lot. So the comparable things was that it wasn't my responsibility to produce Yes. And in a way, that alleviated me from what it had been like quite a lot before, not with Open Your Eyes, but more with the early original record. It was a shared production. So you had to fight for some of your things. And Eddie Offord in the early days was great at being a balancing act, saying, no, that's a better take. I reckon you should do it again, or whatever a producer might have said had there been one brave enough to take us on. So, yeah, marvelous thoughts, memories.
I appreciate that about Bruce Fairbairn. That's why Bruce Fairbairn was Bruce Fairbairn, was because he could approach, you know, a sacred cow like Yes and go to you guys. You guys have lost the plot. You don't know how to make records like you used to. Like, anybody that can walk into a room and say that, yes, to a band is taking their life and their career into their hands, but they have a certain confidence based on what they've done before that they know they can walk in and say that because they've been to the top of the mountain like you guys have.
Well, Trevor did that to us before Heaven and Earth, because I think it was Heaven and Earth. Yeah. Anyway, there's another story where Trevor was very bold and said, you know, we played a whole load of songs. He said, but I don't like those. You know, but I like this one and that one. And I've learned from that I produce Yes now. So sometimes I have to be cut and dried. I have to say, well, look, thinking about this, you know, this is the thing to do, not those, you know. And so it's a responsibility that the producer Bruce had, Trevor had, and now I have. But we all try to do it in the, as they say, Monty Python, in the nicest possible way.
Well, last couple things here, Stephen. You know, it's been said that there's a new Yes album taking shape. Where are kind of things at with that presently?
Well, we're not saying, but we have been writing. You know, we've been working. Hmm. We haven't been idle like we weren't, you know, in previous years when an album would suddenly come out. So that's all I can say.
Well, this fall, Yes is going to be performing the whole of Fragile here in the U.S. Obviously, the band's first album with Rick. But beyond that, with hindsight, what do you kind of appreciate where Yes was at that time with Fragile?
Well, Fragile is really quite a remarkable album to hear, you know, and it's a pleasure to play. Why it's remarkable is that it's so tight-arsed. It's more minimalistic than Yes album with a lot of chordal stuff, you know. So maybe by thinning out the group a bit, you know, when you think about Long Distance Runner, man, there's not a lot really going on. There's not a pad in the background, you know. So basically, it's very straightforward. Because of that, it's powerful. And Eddie was at the primo moment there, where his production skills were really driving us hard. So the techniques and all the input that made particularly Roundabout, South Side of the Sky, Heart of the Sunrise, that made those songs so fantastic. We can still play them now, and they're a great thing to do. So I think it's full of charm, full of gutsy tightness, you know, and it's a very tight ass record, I would say.
That's fantastic. Well, you know what's fantastic about Portraits and Natural Timber coming out is folks can get these records on vinyl for the first time. Are you looking to kind of do that further, you know, to continue to reissue some of the other stuff in your catalog?
Yeah, we've got other plans.
Great.
Other releases in House Sound, and also other further afield releases that were of new music. So basically, next year could be quite interesting.
I love that. Well, Steve, thank you always for the time. Have a great day on that end. And, you know, we'll see you when you come to the States here with Yes.
All right. All the best, man. Been lovely. Thanks. Thanks to chat.
Likewise. Bye-bye. We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing,
Please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.